This idea that a single person can be an agent of change really resonated with me, and I've had a mantra for years, which goes, I am an agent of change, a powerful force for good in the world. And I don't know that I always actualize that as well as I'd like to, but it makes for a good touchstone for me when it's time for me to decide where to focus the awesome.
Hello, everyone! And thank you so much for tuning in to episode 2 of How'd You Become So Awesome?
This week on the show, our guest is Edward H. Carpenter.
Now, Ed is an author, a businessman, an athlete, and a decorated Marine officer. And for our international audience, a Marine is an elite division of the US Armed Forces.
Ed served around the world from Afghanistan to Indonesia. He's also written several books of fiction and nonfiction. He has a slew of qualifications, including his master's in security studies, and he's also an outspoken advocate of women's rights, including especially women in the military. Welcome to the show, Ed, or should we call you Major Edward H. Carpenter?
You can call me anything you like, just don't call me late for dinner.
we'll just stick to Ed.
Now, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. You're traveling around the country at the moment on a book signing mission as well, and you've just released your book, The Warrior Ethos, which is a critique of Stephen Pressfield's book. Can you tell us briefly about that publication?
So I was actually in Afghanistan, and I was reading Pressfield's book because it was required reading for all U.S. Marines, and I found it to be so troubling from a number of perspectives that I started to write a critique article, and then I said, no, this actually needs to be a book. So I wrote the critique, and then I said, it's not enough to explain where somebody else has gone wrong. You ought to explain how to do it better. So then I did a counterpoint, put it all together, published it, and here we are.
Okay, so let's move into the official part of the podcast, Ed, where we talk about your career and try and find out a bit more about how you became to be so awesome. So you're in the military and you're a major, but I don't actually know what that means on a day-to-day basis. And there's probably a lot of listeners out there that feel the same way. So could you just explain for me and them a bit about what you do?
Well, that's an excellent question. I'm not sure I'll be able to give you a very satisfying answer. Because the reality is that what I do on a day-to-day basis changes from time to time. And for me, it's one of the good things. I believe I'm probably a bit of what they call an ADD child these days, but on sort of a grand scale. So I like to focus on something and get really good and be the best at it. But then once I've achieved that, it becomes a bit boring and passe, and I need something more to motivate me. So the military has, in fact, been very good from the perspective that every 2 or 3 years, we generally get moved to a different job. And as time goes by, you tend to get increasing responsibility. So you have sort of this advancing scale of challenges, and you also have a new geographic and sometimes actually work assignment. So fortunately for me, it changes a lot. I've got to do everything from teach Saudi Marines how to use heavy machine guns and mortars and anti-tank rockets, to go study with 150 Indonesian students in a war college in Jakarta, to what I'm doing right now is actually I'm in charge of about 120 Marines. And we provide all the logistical support in terms of supply equipment, bits and piece parts to fix the F-18s and F-35 aircraft in the Marine Corps on the East Coast.
That sounds so, a little so something cool and varied.
And you've also got a history of success as a writer as well, having published your own book. So tell us a little bit about your writing career as well.
Well, the writing career is actually a bit linked into the military career. One of the first books I wrote was when I was in Saudi Arabia. I actually wrote a short story. I just think I wrote it for fun. And it was actually taking the perspective of the wicked queen from all the fairy tales and just looking at the world through her perspective. And it's very interesting when you look at the world through somebody else's perspective. Sometimes they may, in fact, have a very good reason for doing all the things they did, like feeding Snow White poisoned apples and, you know, shooing Cinderella out of the ball. But I didn't do anything with the story, because back then there was no such thing as e-readers, and it was just a little short story, so there was nothing to be done. It was just left in a journal somewhere. And I was in Japan a few years later and reading a passage from a book, was very struck by it and ended up writing a short story around that. But again, it just kind of sat molding around. And I was in Indonesia and I had a Kindle, And it occurred to me, I could actually, take some of these short stories that I had a bunch of piling up, and I could just try publishing one short story on a Kindle and see what happened. And so the rest is pretty much history. I basically did one little short story every so often, and got better and better, and found it was a challenge to design my own covers and learn to do better jobs of editing and formatting. And so by the time I was actually ready to publish an actual full-length book, my counterpoint to Pressfield's Warrior Ethos, I actually had a good bit of practice doing it, and so it was not too difficult.
Wow, now you're incredibly prolific, you're successful in the military, you're successful in publishing, and as you just said, you're doing everything from designing to writing to editing. Was there a tipping point for you in your life, a moment or something that happened that kind of put you onto this trajectory of being prolific, multi-passionate, and just generally awesome?
Well, I actually think that if I had to put a finger on it, I would say it was sometime in the late evening of September 16th, 1973, when my dear mumsy and popsicle brought me into the world. So, actually,
that's a very specific date.
You were awesome from the moment that you were born.
I'm pretty sure I was awesome from the start. However, to be a little more serious, I suppose. Again, this is not one of those things that has a simple answer. And to be quite honest, I have always believed I was destined for great things. But I also firmly believe that we make our own destiny. There's a quote from the original Terminator movie, "No fate but what we make," says
Excellent.
John Connor shortly before he takes one for the team. But yeah, I really do believe in that, and I believe that that can be applied to all people. I've never really had a mentor in the traditional sense of the word. In the military, I've cultivated a useful set of what we sometimes call sea daddies, which are higher-ranking officers who can sort of nudge your career in the right direction with a well-placed word. But when I say cultivated, I mean that I've demonstrated that I'm their number one performer over the course of time, so that when there's something that they have the opportunity to do for me, it's something that they really want to do because they think I'll benefit the organization. The reality is that the path to awesomeness started for me at the age of 14, washing dishes in a roadside restaurant. And I really think that's part of the secret of my success and the success of many folks, is that I've never been afraid to start from the bottom and get my hands dirty, but I've always wanted to be at the top. And I wanted to be at the top so that I could change whatever was wrong with the organization as I saw it at the bottom. And with that said, I think it's important not to forget where you come from, or to forget who's still back down there with their hands in the greasy water supporting all your grand plans. The final thing I would say is that about 80% of any success I've achieved, and probably more, I owe to reading. Reading has really, it has opened my mind to many things. It has opened new worlds to me. And there's a particular book that stands out in my mind. And it's odd because every time I think of this book, I actually have to go and look up who wrote it. But it's a little-known science fiction novel from the late 1980s called Carpe Diem, by a husband-wife team of authors named Sharon Lee and Steve Miller. And it struck a chord with me for two reasons. And the reason I always go back and have to look it up again every once in a while is that its protagonist is considered to be an agent of change. And this idea that a single person can be an agent of change really resonated with me. And I've had a mantra for years, which goes, "I am an agent of change, a powerful force for good in the world." And I don't know that I always actualize that as well as I'd like to, but it makes for a good touchstone for me when it's time for me to decide where to focus the awesome.
Wow. I just want to touch on that agent for change, because you said you started from the bottom and one of the biggest organizations in your life has been the military. Did you get into the military and start from the bottom with an aim to work your way up and make particular changes to the military?
I could tell you the answer to that, but the answer is yes. I have always seen that there are few paths to changing, and for certain organizations, it definitely helps if you work from within. So the simple answer is yes, without incriminating myself.
No, I think definitely your writings in the public space on women in the military would give some hint to things that you might like to see changed.
Well, that's a small example, but I will say that it's important sometimes to I guess, create authenticity. So let's say that I was a liberal arts professor from a college on the West Coast, and I had the exact same opinions and I voiced them with the exact same words. It would be much easier for people to discount me and say, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about, et cetera, et cetera. And there are even those in the military who will say, oh, sure, he's a military guy, but he's not an infantryman, so he also doesn't have the right to say these things. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I think for many, many things, it's important that where you position yourself to be able to have that authenticity when it's time to address big issues.
Mm. So as your professional public self, either as a writer or in the military, what's been some of the biggest challenges that you've faced in your life and how have you overcome them?
So I know that you're a scientist, and as a scientist, you're probably Jade looking for me to give...
I'm a scientist, Beck's a writer.
Let's just say that.
But whether you're a scientist or a writer, you can probably hope that I would give you something that's repeatable and reproducible, so that other people can apply these things and enjoy the same success that I have, correct?
Yeah. Well, one would hope, but it might not be that easy.
One would hope. but here's the thing. I'm going to give you four tried and true Marine Corps epigrams, and I'll give you three because I know we're short on time, and I'll give you three ideas for the future. So the epigrams are these. The first one is one that we use a lot when we're talking to our young Marines, and that is to bloom where you're planted. Whatever job or position you find yourself in, be great at that. In our profession, there are lots of people who think, oh, you know, if I want to be the commander, you know, I've got to do this job, and then I've got to get this job, and I've got to do this and this. And they think that there's a stepping stone. And if they miss some of those stones, that's going to be a problem. My philosophy has always been, whatever job you're put in, be great at that. And that is going to take you on to the next level. My next thought, and this is another one that I share with my Marines, and again, this is it's not a thought everybody's comfortable with, but I would challenge everyone to be the best. Someone has to be number one, so why not you or your team? So isolate what the metric for success is in whatever organization you work in or whatever field you work in, and then break it. And by break it, I mean exceed it. And finally, remember that leadership is not a popularity contest. There are some people who have that natural charisma and people will follow them anywhere, but they are fairly rare. There are other leaders who, if there's a task that needs to be done, sometimes it may be an unpleasant task, and you've got to get it done. So sometimes getting it done will not make you popular with the folks around you. So I tell people to remember that leadership is not a popularity contest. So those three ideas have pretty much got me through everything the Marine Corps has thrown at me or that I've gotten myself into, because I tend to get myself into messes from time to time. But here are my three radical ideas for the future that I think awesome people should embrace and explore as well. The first one is really quick to sum up. The second two will take a little bit longer, but the first one is gamification. Ask yourselves, how do we take the mundane and make it exciting? Universalism. Ask yourselves, can my thing X scale to everyone? Because let me be honest with you. I have made an awesome life for myself as a Marine officer, as the president of my corporation, but neither of those things can scale universally. Not everyone can be a Marine major, and not everyone can be the president of a corporation that basically makes money by renting out houses to other people. If you look at the math, not everybody can run either of those organizations. But my role as a writer and my role as an agent of change, those things, even though they're much less developed and much less lucrative right now, those are universally scalable. So I would ask people to look at what they're doing in their life that is universally scalable. And the third and final interesting thing to think about and look into a little deeper than we'll have a chance to go in this podcast is called useful prosumption. This is scratching the surface of a really deep subject that encompasses things like 3D printing and a lot of other stuff, and I highly recommend reading a book called Revolutionary Wealth by two great futurists, the husband and wife team Alvin and Heidi Toffler, to understand this concept of prosumption. But here's a really quick thumbnail sketch. In historical times, this is before the agricultural revolution, pretty much every human being was a prosumer. That is, you weren't a producer and you weren't a consumer, but you produced the stuff you were going to consume. So let's say you had a vegetable garden. You produced the vegetables and then you ate them. If you were a hunter, you produced your bow and arrows and you went out in the forest, you killed a deer, and then you ate it. And the idea that you were going to have a lot of excess left over to sell to somebody, you know, maybe you had a very little bit. Along came the agriculture and the Industrial Revolution. They kind of turned us into a culture of producers and consumers. So now I produce a great deal of corn, way more than I can eat, and I'm going to eat a little bit of it, but I'm going to sell most of it to somebody else, and I'm going to take the money from that, and now I'm going to go buy that deer meat the other guy had produced. And you kind of created these specialized niches. But now, in today's economy, we have the ability to go back into this prosumption, where we both produce and consume the same material. And let me give you a really easy to visualize example, and that is YouTube videos. So just maybe even a decade ago, people in the movie industry was in a couple of places. It was in Bollywood and it was in Hollywood. Those are the people who had all the equipment and all the money and all the people, the actors, and the props to make movies. Movie making was not something that ordinary people did. So you had the people who were producing the movies in Hollywood, and you were having the people who were consuming the movies throughout the rest of the world. But today, we can actually produce our own movies on YouTube, and we can actually consume other people's movies that they've produced, so we can be prosumers on YouTube. Okay, that's prosumption. As for the useful part, this is something I got from a podcast I was listening to as I was driving up here the other day.
Awesome.
Whatever you're making, whether it's information or material, if you make something useful, something that people really need and really want, you won't need advertising and you won't need hype. People are going to sell it for you. So I would challenge people, as you look into the future as opposed to the past, think about useful prosumption.
There's some cool principles that have just blown both of our minds there. And we're just like sitting here going, wow, yeah, it relates to us so much.
As YouTubers.
But also, I loved what you were discussing at the start about like just being so ambitious and working out the metric for success. It's like not something that many people like dare to dream about, I don't think, is like aiming to be the best.
If somebody's got to be the best. Somebody's got to be number one. So be that person.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you so much for those tips. Now we've got to towards the end of the podcast, we do a section called Final Five, where we give you five questions, rapid fire succession, submitted by our podcast listeners, and you have to respond as fast as possible. Are you ready for the final five, Ed?
I am ready for the final five.
Now, I've actually cut in front of the line of all of our listeners because I have a burning question for you, Ed. So my question is, you publish your goals on medium.com or your weekly goals. Is this something that you would recommend to do to others? Do you have any advice? Because I know a lot of people would like to do this and, you know, think it would be a good thing but haven't got around to it. So what's your experience been?
That's a great question. I'll try and answer that as quickly as possible. This is not my first time publishing goals online. I actually have a couple of blogs over on Blogger. As a writer, you'll find there are a lot of people in the independent writing profession who use online blogging about their goals and about their goal accomplishments. I would challenge you to Google something. Just type in ROW80, row 80. It stands for round of words 80. That is a good example of how this can be used as a tool. I'm actually using it more as a retrospective, like how did I do this week? But I do think it keeps you accountable and it challenges you. It makes you be honest about what you have achieved and what you haven't achieved. So yes, I would definitely recommend it to others.
Great answer. Question number two, I'm asking on behalf of Jane and Lindsay. In a recent interview with the podcasters Jane and Lindsay, you were asked to include the phrase, a day without sunshine is like, you know, nice, which I thought was an excellent phrase. You accepted the challenge. Have you actually used the phrase, and if so, in which publication?
Okay, that is still an open challenge. I have not thought about it. And in fact, it is very likely to show up in a book about Prince Charming. Theoretically, it could be included in a book about the perfidious Mr. Wickham, but I would have to change the language, make it a little bit less Buffy the Vampire Slayer, a little more Regency romance. So I think that this will probably appear sometime in 2015 in a novella about Prince Charming, if I had to guess.
Excellent. We'll keep our eyes out for it.
Definitely.
Now, L in the US asks, if you were going up into space tomorrow and you knew you weren't coming back for 10 years, what books would you bring? Let's say you had to bring five and a Kindle does not count.
Oh, that's a terrible question because first off, if I was in space for 10 years with only five books, I better have a very, very interesting partner in my spacecraft. because otherwise I would go freaking insane. But okay, five books. Revolutionary Wealth is definitely worth it. Something by Bill Bryson that I haven't read, A Short History of Nearly Everything, was a great book, but I've already read it. Probably a good fiction novel that I have not read, perhaps something by Neil Gaiman. But again, he'll have to write a new book so I can go to space. So Neil, please get on that.
Yeah, we second that. Come on, Neil.
Come on, Neil.
I'm sure he is listening to this right now.
I'm sure he is too, yeah.
I should probably bring a really deep science book and teach myself something about, let's say, maybe astrophysics that I didn't know. So that would definitely preoccupy my time some.
Neil deGrasse Tyson's also listening. He's very excited with that choice.
Excellent. And finally, something on philosophy. So again, philosophy, one of the things that I would like to get more into, but a complete history of philosophy I would probably take. If it's possible, I will say to your listeners that I will work with our lovely host to see if I can put up a recommended reading list somewhere that you can access.
Yes.
And they will send you a link because, again, I think reading is just the best thing you can do for your brain. Cool. And everyone should take care of their brain.
Absolutely. We'll put those links in the show notes for all our lovely listeners.
Awesome.
Cool. Question number four, Chelsea in Jakarta asks, what do you miss most about being in Indonesia?
Well, first off, I just want to say, Chelsea, congratulations. You win the internet because that is the best question that I've heard so far. what do I miss about being in Indonesia? I miss nasi goreng in the morning. It's a breakfast food. I miss going clubbing at night. I miss pressure hour at EP. That's Eastern Promise for those of you not in the know. I miss playing rugby with the Jakarta Komodos. And I really, really miss all the awesome friends that I made out there, including you, Jade.
Thank you very much. I thought this is a question 4.5. Do you want to explain to our listeners what pressure hour is?
Okay, so pressure hour is only the most awesome drinking concept ever. There's a bar, and I think it is on Wednesday nights. Anyway, you go in there about what the normal happy hour time is, and beer is free. That, you heard me right. Beer is free, and it is free until one of two things happens. Somebody leaves the bar, or somebody goes to the bathroom. So as many people as want can come into the bar through the open doors, and that's okay, but nobody can leave the bar, and nobody can go to the bathroom, or the free beer gets shut off. So the pressure obviously builds, and yes, I've seen it go very long, and it's a great, great time.
Great for camaraderie.
It is excellent for camaraderie. Everything about Jakarta is really excellent for camaraderie. The general misery of taking a cab, for example, great for camaraderie.
That's true.
Flooding the streets, great for camaraderie.
So, final question. What is one of the biggest sacrifices you've had to make in order to become so awesome? Oh, and that is from Todd in Indonesia. Sorry, Todd. Props to you.
Hey, props to you too, Todd. I'm actually not a big fan of sacrifice in general. There's this idea sometimes that settling down means settling and all that sort of nonsense. But here is what I would say to that. The things that you need to sacrifice to become more awesome is your prejudice, for starters. Everybody has some prejudice. Figure out what yours are and get rid of them because they're holding you back. The other thing that you probably have to sacrifice is your desire to fit in. So awesome people and leaders and creators don't necessarily fit in very well. So sacrifice your prejudice, sacrifice your desire to be one of the herd. And I'm sure there's something else, but that would probably do the trick.
So much value in there. I want to get home and we are home. I want to start tweeting all of your words of wisdom. You're like a Buddha.
That'll be a very short tweet. Good thing only 140 characters.
Yeah, that's true.
I apologize to all of our Twitter followers who are about to be bombarded with Beck's tweets from Ed.
How can listeners find out more about you, Ed? Where is the best place? You have lots of presences over the internet. Is there one central hub or just a few places to go?
Okay, so the most central hub right now, if you just type in ehcarpenter.blogspot.com, you're going to find a page that links you to pretty much all my work on the interwebs. You can also follow me at @E_H_Carpenter, and you can find me on Medium under the same name. But if you find me at any of those places, I can cue you into all the rest.
And just confirming that if they go to your website, they can find a link to get a copy of your brand new book, The Warrior Ethos?
That is correct. There's links to pretty much all my books, I believe, and a bunch of my just other random writing on the web, because I do a great deal of just free writing on the web.
Thank you so much, Ed. This has been an excellent interview, and thank you on behalf of our listeners for all the amazing tips that you've...
You're so awesome. Just so awesome.
That's why
Thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Ed.
Thank you, ladies. Have a wonderful day.